monsters. The rules that said you took a prisoner rather than killed a man. The rules that said you let the stretchers cart the enemy off from no man's land as well as your own men. But always it would come down to the simple question, could he deprive Isabel of this baby? The child was alone in the world. Could it really be right to drag her away from a woman who adored her to some lottery of fate? At night, Tom began to dream he was drowning, flinging his arms and legs, desperately trying to find ground somewhere, but there was nothing to stand on, nothing to hold him afloat except a mermaid whose tail he would grasp and who would then pull him deeper and deeper into the dark water until he awoke, gasping and sweating, while Isabel slept beatifically beside him. Chapter 12.
G'day, Ralph. Good to see you. Where's Blue?
Back here,
shouted the deckhand from the stern, hidden from view by some fruit crates.
How you doing, Tom? Glad to see us?
Always, mate. You're the blokes of the grog, aren't you?
He laughed as he secured the line. The old engine chugged and spluttered as the boat drew alongside, filling the air with thick diesel fumes. It was mid-June, the first time the store boat had visited since the baby's arrival 7 weeks earlier.
Flying Fox is set up, got the winch all ready too.
Struth, you're a bit keen, Tom,
Ralph exclaimed.
Don't want to rush things now, do we? It's a grand day. We can take our time. We've got to see the new arrival after all. My Hilda's piled me up like a pack horse with things for the little and not to mention the proud grandparents.
As Ralph strode off the gangway, he grabbed Tom in a bear hug.
Congratulations, son. Bloody marvellous. Especially after all that's happened before.
Bluey followed suit.
Yeah, good on ya. Ma sends her all the best too.
Tom's eyes wandered to the water. Thanks. Thanks a lot, appreciate it. As they hiked up the path, Isabel was silhouetted against a washing line of nappies, strung out like signal flags, flapping in the brisk wind. Strands of her hair escaped from the roll she just pinned it in. Ralph held his arms out as he approached her.
Well, can't you just tell, eh? Nothing makes a girl bloom like having a littlie. Roses in your cheeks and a shine in your hair, just like my Hilda used to get with each of ours.
Isabel blushed at the compliment and gave the old man a quick kiss. She kissed Bluey too, who bowed his head and muttered,
"Congratulations, Mrs. S."
"Come inside, all of you. Kettle's boiled and there's cake," she said. As they sat at the old deal table, Isabel's glance strayed now and then to the child asleep in a basket.
"Here were the talk of every woman in Partageurs having a baby on your own like that. Of course, the farmers' wives didn't turn a hair. Mary Linford said how she'd had three without any help, but them in town, they were mighty impressed. I hope Tom wasn't too useless."
The couple exchanged a look. Tom was about to speak, but Isabel took his hand and squeezed it tight. "He's been wonderful. I couldn't ask for a better husband." There were tears in her eyes.
"She's a real pretty little thing from what I can see,"
said Bluey. But all that peeped out from the fluffy blanket was a delicate face in a bonnet.
"She's got Tom's nose, hasn't she?"
chipped in Ralph.
"Well," Tom hesitated, "not sure my nose is what you want a baby girl to have."
"I'll take your point,"
Ralph chuckled.
"Right, Mr. Sherborne, my friend. I need your autograph on the forms, might as well sort 'em out now."
Tom was relieved to get up from the table.
"Righto, come through to the office, Captain Addicott, sir,"
he said, leaving Bluey cooing over the basket. The young man reached into the cot and jangled the rattle at the baby, who was now wide awake. She watched it intently and he jiggled it again.
"You're a lucky one, aren't you? Getting a fancy silver rattle? Fit for a princess. I've never seen anything so grand. Angels on the handle and everything. Angels for an angel. And your nice fluffy blanket."
"Oh, they were left over from..." Isabel's voice dropped. "From before." Bluey blushed.
"Sorry, putting me foot in it. I better get on with the unloading. Thanks for the cake."
And he beat a retreat through the kitchen door. Janus Rock, June 1926. "Dear Mum and Dad, well, God has sent us an angel to keep us company. Baby Lucy has captured our hearts. She's a beautiful little girl, absolutely perfect. She sleeps well and feeds well. She's never any trouble. I wish you could see her and hold her. Every day she looks a bit different, and I know by the time you see her, she'll have lost her baby looks. She'll be a toddler when we come back on shore. But in the meantime, here's the nearest thing to a picture. I dipped the sole of her foot in cochineal. You have to be inventive on the lights. See masterpiece attached. Tom is a wonderful dad. Jane has seemed so different now that Lucy's here. At the moment it's pretty easy to look after her. I pop her in a basket and she comes with me when I have to get the eggs or do the milking. Might be a bit harder when she starts to crawl, but I don't want to get ahead of myself. I want to tell you so much about her, how her hair is dark, how beautiful she smells after a bath. Her eyes are quite dark too, but I can't do her justice. She's much too wonderful to describe, and I've only known her a few weeks, and already I can't imagine my life without her. Well, Grandma and Grandpa, I'd better finish this off so the boat can take it, otherwise it'll be another 3 months before you get it. With fondest love, Isabel. P.S. I've just read your letter from the boat this morning. Thanks for the beautiful bunny rug, and the doll is just lovely. Books are wonderful too. I tell her nursery rhymes all the time, so she'll like these new ones. P.P.S. Tom says thanks for the jumper. Winter's starting to bite out here. The new moon was barely a crescent, stitched into the darkening sky. Tom and Isabel were sitting on the veranda as the light swept around far above them. Lucy had fallen asleep in Tom's arms. It's hard to breathe differently from her, isn't it? He said, gazing at the baby. What do you mean? It's like a kind of spell, isn't it? Whenever she's asleep like this, I end up breathing in the same rhythm. Bit like I end up doing things in time to the turning of the light. Almost to himself, he said. Scares me. Isabel smiled. It's just love, Tom. No need to be scared of love. Tom felt a shiver creep through him, just as he couldn't now imagine having lived in this world without meeting Isabel. He realized that Lucy, too, was making her way inside his heart, and he wished she belonged there. Anyone who's worked on the offshore lights can tell you about it, the isolation and the spell it casts. Like spungs flung off the furnace that is Australia, these beacons dot around it, flickering on and off, some of them only ever seen by a handful of living souls. But their isolation saves a whole continent from isolation. Keeps the shipping lanes safe as vessels steam the thousands of miles to bring machines and books and cloth in return for wool and wheat, coal and gold. The fruits of ingenuity traded for the fruits of earth. The isolation spins its mysterious cocoon, focusing the mind on one place, one time, one rhythm, the turning of the light. The island knows no other human voices, no other footprints. On the offshore lights, you can live any story you want to tell yourself, and no one will say you're wrong, not the seagulls, not the prisms, not the wind. So Isabel floats further and further into her world of divine benevolence, where prayers are answered, where babies arrive by the will of God and the working of currents. Tom, I wonder how we can be so lucky, she muses. She watches in awe as her blessed daughter grows and thrives. She revels in the discoveries each day brings for this little being, rolling over, starting to crawl, the first faltering sounds. Storms gradually follow winter into another corner of the earth, and summer comes, bearing a paler blue sky and a sharper gold sun. Up you come, Isabel laughs, and hoists Lucy onto her hip as the three of them stroll down the path to the glinting beach for a picnic. Tom picks different leaves, seagrass, pigface, and Lucy smells them, chews on their ends, pulling faces at the strange sensations. He gathers tiny posies of rose banjine, or shows her the shimmering scales of a trevally or a blue mackerel he has caught off the rocks on the side of the island where the ocean floor drops away into sudden darkness. On still nights, Isabel's voice carries across the air in a soothing lilt as she reads Lucy tales of Snugglepot and Cattle Pie in the nursery, while Tom works on repairs in the shed. Whatever the rights and wrongs of it, Lucy was here now, and Isabel couldn't have been a better mother. Every night in prayer, she gave thanks to God for her family, her health, her much blessed life, and prayed to be worthy of the gifts he had showered on her. Days broke and receded like waves on the beach, leaving barely a trace of the time that passed in this tiny world of working and sleeping and feeding and watching. Isabel shed a tear when she put away some of Livesey's earliest baby things. "Seems only yesterday she was tiny, and now look at her," she mused to Tom, as she folded them carefully away in tissue paper. A dummy, her rattle, her first baby dresses, a tiny pair of kid booties. Just like any mother might do, anywhere in the world. When the blood didn't come, Isabel was excited. When she had given up all hope of another child, her expectations were about to be confounded. She would wait a little longer, keep praying before saying anything to Tom, but she found her thoughts drifting off to daydreams about a brother or sister for Lucy. Her heart was full. Then the bleeding returned with a vengeance, heavier, more painful, in a pattern she couldn't fathom. Her head would ache, and sometimes she would sweat at night, then the months would pass with no blood at all. "I'll go and see Dr. Sumpton when we get our shore leave. No need to fuss," she told Tom. She carried on without complaint. "I'm strong as an ox, Dale. There's nothing to worry about." She was in love with her husband and with her baby, and that was enough. The months trailed by, marked with the peculiar rituals of the lighthouse, lighting up, hoisting the ensign, draining the mercury bath to filter out stray oil. All the usual form-filling and compliance with the bullying correspondent from the foreman artificer about how any damage to the vapor tubes could only be caused by lightkeeper negligence, not faulty workmanship. The logbook changed from 1926 to 1927 in meat page. There was no wasting paper in the CLS. Books were expensive. Tom pondered the institutional indifference to the arrival of a new year, as though the lights were not impressed by something as prosaic as mere reflection of time. And it was true. The view from the gallery on New Year's Day was indistinguishable from that of New Year's Eve. Occasionally he would still find himself revisiting the page for 27th of April 1926, until the book opened there of its own accord. Isabel worked hard. The vegetable patch thrived, the cottage was kept clean. She washed and patched Tom's clothes and cooked the things he liked. Lucy grew. The light turned. Time passed. Chapter 13.
"It's coming up for a year soon," said Isabel. 27th of April's her birthday. Well, near enough."
Tom was in the workshop, filing away rust from a bent door hinge. He put down the rasp.
"I wonder, you know, what a real birthday is. The day she arrived's good enough for me."
Isabel kissed the child who was sitting astride her hip, gnawing on a crust. Lucy reached out her arms to Tom.
"Sorry, Lidley. My hands are filthy. You're better off with Mama just now." "I can't believe how much she's grown. She weighs a ton these days."
Isabel laughed and gave Lucy a heave to settle her higher on her hip.
"I'm going to make a birthday cake."
The child responded by dipping her head into Isabel's chest and dribbling bits of bread onto her.
"That tooth's giving you trouble, isn't it, sweetie? Your cheeks are so red. Should we put some teething powder on it?"
Turning to Tom, she said, "See you in a little while, Dale. Better get back. Soup's still on the stove." She left for the cottage. The steely light pierced the window and scoured Tom's workbench. He had to hammer the metal straight, and each blow rang sharply off the walls. Though he found himself striking with more force than was necessary, he couldn't stop. There was no getting away from the feeling stirred up by talk of birthdays and anniversaries. He set to work with the hammer again, the blows no less heavy, until the metal snapped from the force. He picked up the shattered halves and stared at them. Tom looked up from the armchair. A few weeks had passed since the baby's birthday celebration.
"Doesn't matter what you read to her," said Isabel. "It's just good for her to get used to hearing different words."
She deposited Lucy on his lap and went to finish making the bread.
"Dad, dad, dad, dad," said the child. "Bub, bub, bub," said Tom. "So, you want a story?"
The little hand reached out, but instead of pointing to the heavy book of fairy tales on the table beside them, grabbed a beige booklet and pushed it at him. He laughed.
"I don't think you'll like that one much, Bunny Rabbit. No pictures in it for a start."
He reached for the fairy tales, but Lucy thrust the booklet in his face.
Dad!
That's the one you want, little Lee, he laughed again. The child opened it at a page and pointed at the words like she'd seen Tom and Isabel do.
All right, began Tom.
Instructions to Lightkeepers, number 29. Lightkeepers are never to allow any interests, private or otherwise, to interfere with the discharge of their duties, which are of the greatest importance to the safety of navigation. And they are reminded that their retention or promotion in the service depends on their strict obedience to orders, adherence to the rules laid down for their guidance. Industry, sobriety, and the maintenance of cleanliness and good order in their own persons and family, as well as in every part of the lighthouse establishment and premises. Number 30. Misconduct, disposition to quarrel, insobriety or immorality on the part of any keeper. He paused to retrieve Lucy's fingers from his nostrils. Will render the offender liable to punishment or dismissal. The committing of any such offence by any member of the lightkeeper's family will render the offender liable to exclusion from the lighthouse station. He stopped. A chill had crept through him and his heart beat faster. He was summoned back to the present by a tiny hand coming to rest on his chin. He pressed it to his lips absently. Lucy grinned at him and gave him a generous kiss.
Come on, let's read Sleeping Beauty instead, he said, and took up the fairy tales, though he found it hard to concentrate.
Here you are. Tea and toast in bed, ladies, said Tom, resting the tray beside Isabel.
Careful, Luce, said Isabel.
She'd brought the toddler into bed that Sunday after Tom had gone to extinguish the light, and the child was clambering towards the tray to reach the small cup of tea Tom had made her to. Hardly more than warm milk with a drop of colour. Tom sat beside Isabel and pulled Lucy onto his knee.
Here we go, Lulu, he said, and helped her steady the cup in both hands as she drank.
He was concentrating on his task until he became aware of Isabel's silence and turned to see tears in her eyes.
Izzy, what's wrong, Dal?
Nothing at all, Tom. Nothing at all.
He brushed a tear away from her cheek.
Sometimes I'm so happy it frightens me, Tom.
He stroked her hair and Lucy started to blow bubbles into the tea.
Listen, Miss Muffet, are you going to drink that or have you had enough for now?
The child continued to slobber into the cup, clearly pleased with the sounds.
Okay, I think we'll give it a rest for now.
He eased the cup away from her and she responded by climbing off him and onto Isabel, still blowing bubbles of spittle.
Charming, said Isabel, laughing through her tears. Come here, you little monkey.
And she blew a raspberry on her tummy. Lucy giggled and squirmed and said,
Gain.
And Isabel obliged.
You two are as bad as each other, said Tom.
Sometimes I feel a bit drunk with how much I love her.
And you?
Like if they asked me to walk one of those straight lines, I couldn't.
No straight lines on Jana, so you're all right in that score, said Tom.
Don't mock, Tom. It's like I was colourblind before, Lucy, and now the world's completely different. It's brighter and I can see further. I'm in exactly the same place, the birds are the same, the water's the same, the sun rises and sets just like it always did, but I never knew what for, Tom.
She drew the child into her.
Lucy's the what for, and you're different too.
How?
I think there are bits of you you didn't know existed until she came along. Corners of your heart that life had shut down.
She traced a finger along his mouth.
I know you don't like to talk about the war and everything, but it must have made you numb.
My feet made my feet numb more than often or not. Frozen mud'll do that to a bloke.
Tom could only manage a half a smile at the attempted joke.
Stop it, Tom. I'm trying to say something. I'm being serious, for goodness sake, and you just send me packing with some silly joke like I'm a child who doesn't understand or can't be trusted with the truth.
This time Tom was deadly serious.
You don't understand, Isabel. No civilized person ever should have to understand. Trying to describe it would be like passing on a disease.
He turned towards the window. I did what I did so that people like you and Lucy could forget it ever happened. So that it would never happen again. War to end all wars, remember? Doesn't belong here, on this island, in this bed. Tom's features had hardened and she glimpsed a resolve she'd never seen in him before. The resolve she'd imagined that had got him through everything he'd been through.
It's just, Isabel began again.
Well, we none of us know whether we're around for another year or another 100 years. And I wanted to make sure you knew how thankful I am to you, Tom. For everything. Especially for giving me Lucy.
Tom's smile froze at the last words, and Isabel hurried on.
You did, Dal. You understood how much I needed her, and I know that cost you, Tom. Not many men would do that for their wife.
Jolted back from some dream world, Tom could feel his palms sweating. His heart started to race with the urge to run anywhere, it didn't matter where, just as long as it was away from the reality of the choice he had made, which suddenly seemed to weigh like an iron collar.
Tom was getting on with some work. I'll leave you two to have your toast, he said, and left the room as slowly as he could manage.
Chapter 14. When Tom's second 3-year term came to an end, just before Christmas 1927, a family from Janus Rock made its first journey to Point Partageuse while a relief keeper manned the light station. The couple's second shore leave, it would be Lucy's first voyage to the mainland. As Isabel had prepared for the arrival of the boat, she had toyed with finding an excuse to stay behind with the little girl in the safety of Janus.
You okay, Is?
Tom had asked when he saw her, suitcase open on the bed, staring blankly through the window.
Oh, yes, she said quickly. Just making sure I packed everything.
He was about to leave the room when he doubled back and put his hand on his shoulder.
Nervous.
She snatched up a pair of socks and rolled them together in a ball.
No, not at all, she said as she stuffed them in the case. Not at all.
The unease Isabel had tried to hide from Tom vanished at the sight of Lucy in Violet's arms, when her parents came to greet them at the jetty. Her mother wept and smiled and laughed all at the same time.
At last!
She shook her head in awe, inspecting every inch of the child, touching her face, her hair, her little hand.
My blessed granddaughter! Fancy waiting nearly 2 years to lay eyes on you, and isn't she just the image of my old Auntie Clem?
Isabel had spent months preparing Lucy for exposure to people.
In Partageuse, Luce, there are lots and lots of people, and they'll all like you. Might be a bit strange at first, but there's no need to be scared.
At bedtime, she had told the girl stories of the town and the people who lived in it. Lucy responded with great curiosity to the endless supply of humans that now surrounded her. Isabel felt a twinge as she accepted the warm congratulations of townspeople on her pretty daughter. Even old Mrs. Mewett tickled the little girl under the chin when she saw her in the haberdasher's as she was buying a hairnet.
Ah, little ones, she said wistfully. Such blessings.
Leaving Isabel to wonder whether she was hearing things. Almost as soon as they arrived, Violet packed the whole family off to Gutsch's photographic studio. In front of a canvas backdrop painted with ferns and Greek columns, Lucy had been photographed with Tom and Isabel, with Bill and Violet, and on her own, perched on a grand wicker chair. Copies were ordered to take back to Janus, to send to cousins far afield, to have framed for the mantelpiece and the piano.
3 generations of Graysmark women, beamed Violet when she saw herself with Lucy on her knee sitting beside Isabel.
Lucy had grandparents who doted on her.
God doesn't make mistakes, thought Isabel.
He'd sent the little girl to the right place.
Oh, Bill, Violet said to her husband the evening the family arrived. Thank goodness. Thank goodness.
Violet had last seen her daughter 3 years before, still grieving at her second miscarriage on the couple's first shore leave. Then Isabel had sat with her head on her mother's lap, weeping.
It's just nature's way, Violet had said. You have to take a breath and get up again. Children will come along. If that's what God wants for you, just be patient. And pray. Praying's the most important thing. She did not tell Isabel the whole truth of it, though. She did not say how often she'd seen a child carried to term over the draining, withering summer or the whip-sharp winter, only to be lost to scarlet fever or diphtheria, their clothes folded away neatly until they might fit the next one down. Nor did she touch on the awkwardness of replying to a casual inquiry as to the number of children one had. Successful delivery was merely the first step of a long, treacherous journey. In this house which had fallen silent years ago, Violet knew that only too well. Reliable, dutiful Violet Graysmark, respectable wife of a respectable husband. She kept the moths out of the cupboards, the weeds out of the flower beds. She deadheaded the roses to persuade them into blooming even in August. Her lemon curd always sold out first at the church fete, and it was her fruitcake recipe which had been chosen for the local CWA booklet. True, she thanked God every night for her many blessings. But some afternoons, as the sunset turned the garden from green to a dull dun while she peeled potatoes over the sink, there just wasn't enough room in her heart to hold all the sadness. As Isabel had cried during that previous visit, Violet had wanted to wail with her, to tear her hair and tell her she knew the grief of losing the firstborn. How nothing, no person, no money, no thing that this earth could offer, could ever make up for that, and that the pain would never, never go away. She wanted to tell her how it made you mad, made you bargain with God about what offering you could sacrifice to get your child back. When Isabel had been safely asleep, and Bill was dozing beside the last of the fire, Violet went to her wardrobe and fetched down the old biscuit tin. She fished around in it, moving aside a few pennies, a small mirror, watch, a wallet, until she came to the envelope, frayed at the edges now from years of opening. She sat on the bed, by the yellow light of the lamp, set to reading the clumsy script, though she knew the words by heart.
Dear Mrs. Graysmark, I hope you'll forgive me for writing to you. You don't know me. My name is Betsy Parmenter, and I live in Kent. 2 weeks ago, I was visiting my son Fred, who was sent back from the front on account of bad shrapnel wounds. He was in the 1st Southern General Hospital in Stourbridge, and I have a sister who lives nearby, so I was able to visit him every day. Well, I'm writing because one afternoon they brought in a wounded Australian soldier who I understand was your son Hugh. He was in a bad way, on account, as you will know, of being blinded and lost an arm. He could still manage some words, though, and spoke very fondly of his family and his home in Australia. He was a very brave lad. I saw him each day, and at one stage there was high hopes that he would recover. But then it seems he developed blood poisoning and he went downhill. I just wanted you to know that I bought him flowers. The early tulips were just blooming, and they're such lovely things. And some cigarettes. I think my Fred and him got along well. He even ate some fruit cake I bought in one day, which was very pleasing to see, and it seemed to give him pleasure. I was there the morning when he went downhill, and we all three said the Lord's Prayer, and we sang Abide with Me. The doctors eased his pain as best they could, and I think he did not suffer too much at the end. There was a vicar came and blessed him. I would like to say how much we all appreciate the great sacrifice that your brave son made. He mentioned his brother Alfie, and I pray that he comes back to you safe and sound. I'm sorry for the delay in writing this to you. Only my Fred passed away a week after your boy, and it has taken a lot of doing things, as you can imagine. With very best wishes and prayers, Mrs. Betsy Parmenter. Hugh would have only known tulips from picture books, Violet thought, and it comforted her that perhaps he touched one, felt its shape. She wondered whether tulips had a scent. She recalled how the postman had looked grave and almost guilty a couple of weeks later as he handed her the parcel. Brown paper tied with string, addressed to Bill. She was so upset that she did not even read the printing on the form. She did not need to. Many a woman had received the meagre collection of things which constituted her son's life. The receipt form from Melbourne read, Dear Sir, forward herewith, per separate registered post is one package containing the effects of the late number 4497 Private Graysmark, 28th Battalion,
Received ex Thermistocles as per inventory attached. I shall be much obliged if you would kindly let me know whether it comes safely to hand by signing and returning the enclosed printed receipt slip. Yours faithfully, J.M. Johnson, Major, Officer in Charge, Base Records. On a separate slip of paper from the kit store, 110 Greyhound Road, Fulham, London, SW, was the inventory of effects. Violet was struck by something as she read the list. Shaving mirror, belt, 3 pennies, wristwatch with leather strap, harmonica. How odd that Alfie's mouth organ was amongst Hugh's belongings. Then she looked again at the list, the forms, the letter, the parcel, and read the name more carefully. A.H. Graysmark. Not H.A. Alfred Henry, not Hugh Albert. She ran to find her husband.
Bill! Oh, Bill! She cried. It's been the most dreadful mistake!
It took a good deal of correspondence on black-edged paper on the part of the Graysmarks to find that Alfie had died within a day of Hugh, 3 days after arriving in France. Joining the same regiment on the same day, the brothers had been proud of their consecutive service numbers. The signalman, who had with his own eyes seen Hugh shipped out alive on a stretcher, disregarded the instruction to send the KIA telegram for A.H. Graysmark, assuming it meant H.A. The first Violet knew of her second son's death was the bland package in her hands. It was an easy enough mistake to have made on the battlefield, she had said. Coming back last time to the house she grew up in, Isabel had been reminded of the darkness that had descended with her brother's deaths, how loss had leaked all over her mother's life like a stain. As a 14-year-old, Isabel had searched the dictionary. She knew that if a wife lost a husband, there was a whole new word to describe who she was. She was now a widow. Her husband became a widower. But if a parent lost a child, there was no special label for their grief. They were still just a mother or father, even if they no longer had a son or daughter. That seemed odd. As to her own status, she wondered whether she was still technically a sister, now that her adored brothers had died. It was as if one of the shells from the French front line had exploded in the middle of her family, leaving a crater that she could never fill or repair. Violet would spend days tidying her son's rooms, polishing the silver frames of their photographs. Bill became silent. Whatever topic of conversation Isabel tried to engage him in, he didn't answer, or even wandered out of the room. Her job, she decided, was not to cause her parents any more bother or concern. She was the consolation prize, what they had instead of their sons. Now, her parents' rapture confirmed to Isabel that she'd done the right thing in keeping Lucy. Any lingering shadows were swept away. The baby had healed so many lives, not only hers and Tom's, but now the lives of these two people had been so resigned to loss. At Christmas lunch, Bill Graysmark said grace and in a choked voice thanked the Lord for the gift of Lucy. In the kitchen later, Violet confided to Tom that her husband had a new lease of life from the day that he'd heard about Lucy's birth. It's done wonders, like a magic tonic. She goes through the window at the pink hibiscus. Bill took the news about Hugh hard enough, but when he found out about Alfie, fear knocked him for six. For a long time he wouldn't believe it, said it was impossible that such a thing could have happened. He spent months riding here, there and everywhere, determined to show it was a mistake. In a way, I was glad of it, proud of him for fighting the news. But there were plenty of people hereabouts who'd lost more than one boy. I knew it was true. Eventually the fire went out of him, he just lost heart. She took a breath. But these days, she raised her eyes and smiled in wonder, he's his old self again, thanks to Lucy. I'd wager your little girl means as much to Bill as she does to you. She's given him the world back. She reached up and kissed Tom's cheek. Thank you. As the women did the dishes after lunch, Tom sat out the back on the shady grass with Lucy, where she toddled about, circling back now and again to give him ravenous kisses. Jeez, thanks, Lily, he chuckled. Don't eat me. She looked at him with those eyes that sought his like a mirror until he pulled her into him and tickled her again. Ah, perfect dad, said a voice from behind. Tom turned to see his father-in-law approaching. "Thought I'd come and make sure you were managing. I always said I had a knack with R3. As the last word came out, a shadow flitted across his face. He recovered and stretched out his arms. "Come to Grandpa. Come and pull his whiskers. Oh, my little princess." Lucy tottered over and stretched out her arms. "Up you come," he said, sweeping her up. She reached for the fob watch in his waistcoat pocket and tugged it out. "You want to know what time it is? Again?" Bill laughed, and he went through the ritual of opening the gold case and showing her the hands. She immediately snapped it shut and thrust it back to him to reopen. "It's hard on Violet, you know," he said to Tom. Tom brushed the grass off his trousers as he stood up. "What is, Bill?" "Being without Isabel and now missing out on this little one." He paused. "It must be jobs you could get around Partager's way. You've got a university degree, for goodness sake." Tom shifted his weight uneasily to his other foot. "Oh, I know what they say. Once a light keeper, always a light keeper." "That's what they say," said Tom. "And is it true?" "More or less. But you could leave, if you really want to." Tom gave it thought before replying. "Bill, a man could leave his wife if he really wanted to. Doesn't make it the right thing to do." Bill gave him a look. "Hardly fair to let them train you up, get the experience, and then leave them in the lurch. And you get used to it." He glanced up at the sky as he considered. "It's where I belong, and Isabel loves it." The child reached out her arms to Tom, who transferred her to his hip in a reflex movement. "Well, you mind you look after my girls, that's all I'm saying. I'll do my best, I promise you that." The most important Boxing Day tradition in Point Partagers was the church fete. A gathering of residents from the town and far beyond. It had been established long ago by someone with an eye for business and who had seen the advantage of holding the fundraising event on a day when no one had an excuse to say they were too busy with work to attend. And, it still being Christmas time, they had no excuse not to be generous either. As well as the sale of cakes and toffees, the jars of jams that occasionally exploded in the fierce sun, the event was famous for its sports and novelty events. The egg and spoon race, the three-legged race, sack race were all staples of the day. The coconut shy still ran, though they'd given up the shooting gallery after the war, because the newly honed skills of the local men meant that it started to lose money. The events were open to all, and participation was something of a three-line whip. Families made a day of it, and patties and sausages were barbecued over a half 44-gallon drum, and sold off at sixpence a go. Tom sat with Lucy and Isabel on a blanket in the shade, eating sausages in buns, while Lucy dismantled her lunch and redistributed it on the plate beside her. "The boys were great runners," Isabel said. "They even used to win the three-legged race, and I think Mum still got the cup I won for the sack race one year." Tom smiled. "Didn't know I'd married a champion athlete." She gave him a playful slap on the arm. "I'm just telling you the Graysmark family legends." Tom was attending to the mess that threatened to spill over from Lucy's plate when a boy with a Marshall's rosette appeared beside them. Clasping a pad and pencil, he said, "Excuse me, that your baby?" The question startled Tom. "Pardon?" "Just asking if that's your baby." Though the words came from Tom's mouth, they were incoherent. The boy turned to Isabel. "That your baby, missus?" Isabel frowned for a second and then gave a slow nod as she understood. "You on the round-up for the dad's race?" "That's right." He lifted the pencil to the page and asked Tom, "How do you spell your name?" Tom looked again at Isabel, but there was no trace of discomfort in her face. "I can spell it if you've forgotten how," she teased. Tom waited for her to understand his alarm, but her smile didn't waver. Finally said, "Not really my strong point, running." "But all the dads do it," said the boy, at what was clearly the first refusal he'd come across. Tom chose his words carefully. "I wouldn't make the qualifying round." As the boy wandered off to find his next conscript, Isabel said lightly, "Never mind, Lucy. I'll go in the mum's race instead. At least one of your parents is prepared to make a fool of themselves for you.
but Tom didn't return her smile. Dr. Sumpton washed his hands as behind the curtain Isabel dressed again. She had kept her promise to Tom to see the doctor while they were back in Pardeshers.
"Nothing wrong, mechanically speaking," he said.
"So what is it? Am I sick?"
"Not at all. It's just the change of life," the doctor said as he wrote up his notes. "You're lucky enough to have a baby already, so it's not as hard on you as it is on some women, when it comes unusually early like this. As for the other symptoms, well, I'm afraid you'll just have to grin and bear it. They'll pass in a year or so. It's just the way of things."
He gave her a jolly smile.
"And then it'll be a blessed relief. You'll be past all the problems of menses. Some women would envy you."
As she walked back to her parents' house, Isabel tried not to cry. She had Lucy. She had Tom. At a time when many women had lost forever those they loved most, it would be greedy to want anything more.
A few days later, Tom signed the paperwork for another 3-year term. The district officer, who came down from Fremantle to see the formalities, again paid close attention to his handwriting and signature, comparing them to his original documentation. Any sign of a tremor creeping into his hand and he wouldn't be allowed back. Mercury poisoning was common enough. If they could catch it at the stage where it just caused shaky handwriting, they could avoid sending out a keeper, who, like as not, would be mad as a meat axe by the end of his next stint. Chapter 15. Lucy's christening, originally arranged for the first week of their leave, had been postponed because of the lengthy indisposition of Reverend Norkles. Finally took place the day before their return to Janus in early January. That scorching morning, Ralph and Hilda walked to the church with Tom and Isabel. The only shade to be had while they waited for the doors to open was under a cluster of mallee trees besides the gravestones.
"Let's hope Norkles isn't on another bender," said Ralph.
"Ralph, really?" said Hilda.
To change the subject, she tutted at a fresh granite stone a few feet away.
"Such a shame."
"What is, Hilda?" asked Isabel.
"Oh, the poor baby and her father. The ones that drowned. At least they've finally got a memorial."
Isabel froze. For a moment she feared she might faint and the sounds around her became distant and then suddenly booming. She struggled to make sense of the bright gold lettuce on the stone. In loving memory of Franz Johannes Roenfeld, dearly beloved husband of Hannah, and of their precious daughter, Grace Ellen, watched over by God. Then under that, "Selig sind die dein Leid tragen." Fresh flowers lay at the foot of the memorial. With this heat, they couldn't have been left more than an hour before.
"What happened?" she asked as a tingling spread to her hands and feet. "Oh, shocking," said Ralph with a shake of his head. "Hannah Potts, as was."
Isabel recognized the name immediately.
"Septimus Potts. Old Potts of Money, they call him. Richest fella for miles. He came here from London 50-odd years back as an orphan with nothing. Made a fortune in timber. Wife died when his two girls were only small. What's the other one's name, Hilda?"
"Gwen. Hannah's the oldest. Both went to that fancy boarding school up in Perth.
Then a few years back, Hannah went and married a Hun. Well, old Potts wouldn't speak to her after that. Cut off the money. They lived in that run-down cottage down by the pumping station. Old man finally came around when the baby was born. Anyway, it was a bit of a barney on Anzac Day, year before last now."
"Not now, Ralph," Hilda cautioned with a look.
"Just telling him.
This is hardly the time or place." She turned to Isabel. "Let's just say there was a misunderstanding between Frank Roenfeld and some of the locals, and he ended up jumping into a rowing boat with the baby. They took against him because he was German, or as good as. No need to go into all of that here, at a christening and all. Better forgotten."
Isabel had stopped taking breaths as she listened to the tale, and now gave an involuntary gasp as her body clamoured for air.
"Yes, I know," Hilda said to show her agreement, "and it gets worse."
Tom glanced urgently at Isabel, his eyes wide, sweat beating on his lip. He wondered if it was possible for others to hear his heart beating that was thundering so wildly,
Well, the bloke was no sailor, Ralph went on. Had a dicky heart since he was a kid, by all accounts. He was no match for these currents. Storm blew up and no one saw hide nor hair of him again. Must have drowned. Old man Potts put up a reward for information. 1,000 guineas. He gave a shake of the head. That would have brought him out of the woodwork if anyone knew anything. I even had a mind to look for him myself. Mind you, I'm no Bosch lover, but the baby, barely 2 months old, you can't hold it against a baby now, can you, little mite? Poor Hannah never recovered, sighed Hilda. Her father only persuaded her to put up the memorial a few months ago. She paused as she pulled her gloves up. Funny how lives turn out, isn't it? Born to more money than you can shake a stick at. Went all the way to Sydney University to get a degree in something or other. Married the love of her life. And you see her now sometimes, wandering about like she's got no home to go to.
Now Isabel felt plunged into ice, as the flowers in the memorial taunted her, threatened her with the closeness of the mother's presence. She leaned against a tree, dizzy.
Are you all right, dear?
Asked Hilda, concerned at the sudden change in her colour.
Yes, it's just the heat. I'll be all right in a minute.
The heavy jarrah doors swung open and the vicar stepped out of the church.
All ready for the big day, then?
He asked, wincing at the light.
We've got to say something, now. Call off the christening.
Tom's voice was low and urgent as he faced Isabel in the vestry, while Bill and Violet showed off their granddaughter to the guests in the church.
Tom, we can't.
Her breath was shallow and her face was pale.
It's too late, she said.
We have to put this right. We have to tell people, now.
We can't.
Still reeling, she cast about for any words that made sense.
We can't do that to Lucy. We're the only parents she's ever known. Besides, what would we say? That we suddenly remembered that I didn't actually have a baby?
Her face turned grey.
What about the man's body? It's all gone too far.
Every instinct told her to buy time. She was too confused, too terrified to do anything else. She tried to sound calm.
We'll talk about it later. Right now we have to go through with the christening.
A shaft of light caught the sea-green irises of her eyes, and Tom could see the fear in them. She took a step towards him and he sprang back, as if they were opposing magnets. The vicar's footsteps rose above the murmur of the guests in the church as he approached. Tom's head spun. In sickness and in health, for better or for worse. The words uttered by him in this church years earlier thudded in his skull.
All ready for you, beamed the vicar.
Hath this child already been baptized, or no? Began Reverend Norcals.
Those gathered at the font replied, no. Alongside Tom and Isabel, Ralph stood as godfather, Isabel's cousin Frieda as godmother. The godparents held candles and intoned the answers to the vicar's questions.
Dost thou, in the name of this child, renounce the devil and all his works?
I renounce them all.
The godparents replied in unison. As the words echoed off the sandstone walls, Tom looked sternly at his shiny new boots and concentrated on a burning blister on his heel.
Wilt thou then obediently keep God's holy will and commandments?
I will.
With each promise, Tom flexed his foot against the stiff leather, immersing himself in the pain. Lucy seemed mesmerized by the fireworks of the stained glass windows, and it occurred to Isabel, even in her turmoil, that the child had never seen such brilliant colours.
O merciful God, grant that the old Adam in this child may be so buried that the new man may be raised up in her.
Tom thought of the unmarked grave on Janus. He saw the face of Frank Rowenfeld as he had covered it with canvas, detached, expressionless, leaving Tom to be his own accuser. Outside, the noise of children playing French cricket in the church playground peppered the air with thracks and cries of,
"How's that?"
In the second row of pews, Hilda Adicott whispered to her neighbour,
"Look, Tom's got a tear in his eye. Now that's a soft heart for you. He may look a great rock of a man, but it's a real soft heart he's got."
Norcals took the child into his arms and said to Ralph and Frieda,
Name this child.
Lucy Violet, they said.
Lucy Violet, I baptize thee in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, said the priest, pouring water on the head of the little girl, who let out a shriek of protest, soon accompanied by Mrs. Rafferty coaxing Crimond out of the decrepit wooden organ. Before the service had finished, Isabel excused herself and hurried to the outhouse at the end of the path. The small brick space was as hot as an oven, and she shooed away flies before leaning over to retch violently. A gecko clung to the wall, watching her in silence. When she pulled a chain, it scampered up to the tin roof to safety. As she rejoined her parents, she said weakly, "Upset, dummy," to head off her mother's inquiries. Holding out her arms for Lucy, she hugged her so tight that the child put her hands to Isabel's chest and levered herself away a little. At the christening lunch at the Palace Hotel, Isabel's father sat at the table with Violet, who was wearing her blue cotton shift with the white lace collar. Her corset was pinching, and the bun into which she had tied it her hair was giving her a headache. She was determined, however, that nothing would spoil this day. The christening of her first, and now she understood from Isabel, her only grandchild.
"Tom doesn't seem his usual self today, does he, Vi? Not usually much of a drinker, but he's on the whiskey today."
Bill shrugged as if to convince himself.
"Just wetting the baby's head, I suppose. I think it's just nerves, such a big day. Isabel's come over all touchy too, probably that tummy trouble."
Over at the bar with Tom, Ralph said,
"That little girl's made all the difference to your missus, hasn't she? She's like a new woman."
Tom turned his empty glass round and round in his hands. "It's brought out a different side of her, all right. When I think back to how she lost the baby." Tom gave an imperceptible start, but Ralph went on. "That first time, it was like seeing a ghost when I came out to Janus, and the second was worse. Yeah, they were hard times for her. Ah, well, God comes good in the end, doesn't he?" Ralph smiled.
"Does he, Ralph? Can't come good for everyone, can he? Couldn't come good for Fritz as well as us, say?"
"That's no way to be talking, boy. He's come good for you."
Tom loosened his tie and collar. Suddenly the bar felt stifling.
"You all right, mate?" asked Ralph.
"Stuffy in here. Think I'll go for a bit of a wander."
But outside was no better. The air seemed solid, like molten glass that suffocated him rather than letting him breathe. If he could talk to Isabel alone, calmly, things would be all right. It could be all right, somehow. He drew himself up, taking a deep breath, and walked slowly back into the hotel.
"She's fast asleep," said Isabel as she closed the door to the bedroom where the child lay surrounded by pillows to keep her from rolling off the edge of the bed. "She was so good today. Got through the whole christening with all those people. Only cried when she got wet."
As the day went on, her voice had lost the tremor it had acquired with Hilda's revelation.
"Oh, she's an angel," said Violet, smiling. "I don't know what we'll do with ourselves when she goes back tomorrow."
"I know, but I promise I'll write and I'll tell you all her news," Isabel said, and gave a sigh. "We'd better turn in, I suppose. Got to be up at crack of dawn for the boat. You coming, Tom?"
Tom gave a nod.
"Night, Violet.
Night, Bill," he said, and left them to their jigsaw puzzle as he followed Isabel into the bedroom. It was the first time they had been alone together all day, and as soon as the door was closed, he demanded, "When are we going to tell them?" His face was tight, his shoulders stiff.
"We're not,"
replied Isabel in an urgent whisper.
"What do you mean?" "We need to think, Tom. We need time. We have to leave tomorrow. All hell break loose if we say anything, and you're supposed to be back on duty tomorrow night. We'll work out what to do once we get back to Janus. We mustn't rush into something we'll regret."
Is a woman here in town who thinks her daughter's dead when she's alive. Doesn't know what happened to her husband. God knows what she's been through. The sooner we put her out of her misery. It's all such a shock. We have to do the right thing, not just by Hannah Potts, but by Lucy as well. Please, Tom, neither of us can think straight at the moment. Let's take this slowly. Right now, let's just try and get a bit of sleep before the morning."
"I'll turn in later," he said. "I need some fresh air.
He slipped quietly out to the back veranda, ignoring Isabel's plea to stay. Outside it was cooler, and Tom sat in the darkness in a cane chair, his head in his hands. Through the kitchen window he could hear the clack-clack as Bill put the last pieces of the jigsaw back into its wooden box.
Isabel seems so keen to get back to Janus. Says she's not good with crowds anymore, Bill said as he put the lid on.
You'd be hard-pressed to muster a real crowd this side of Perth. Violet was trimming the wick of the kerosene lamp.
Well, she always was highly strung, she mused. Between you and me, I think she just wants to have Lucy all to herself, she sighed. It'll be quiet without the little one around.
Bill put his arms around Violet's shoulders. Brings back memories, doesn't it? Remember Hugh and Alfie when they were tots? Ah, grand little fellas they were, he chuckled. Remember that time they shut the cat in the cupboard for days? He paused. It's not the same, I know, but being grandfather's the next best thing, isn't it? Next best thing to having the boys back.
Violet lit the lamp.
There were times I didn't think we'd get through it all, Bill. Didn't think we could ever have another day's happiness.
She blew out the match.
Such a blessing, at last.
Placing the glass shade, she guided the way to bed. The words reverberated in Tom's mind as he breathed in the night jasmine, its sweetness oblivious to his desperation. Chapter 16. The first night back on Janus, the wind howled around the lantern room, pushing at the thick panes of glass in the tower, testing for some weak spot. As Tom lit up, his mind went over and over the argument he had had with Isabel as soon as the storeboat had left. She'd been unmovable.
We can't undo what's happened, Tom. Don't you think I've been trying to find an answer?
She was clasping the doll she'd just picked up from the floor, hugging it to her chest.
Lucy's a happy, healthy little girl. Ripping her away now would be... Oh, Tom, it'd be horrible.
She'd been folding sheets into the linen press, pacing to and fro between the basket and the cupboard.
For better or worse, Tom, we did what we did. Lucy adores you, and you adore her, and you don't have the right to deprive her of a loving father.
What about her loving mother? Her living bloody mother? How can this be fair, Is?
Her face flushed. Do you think it's fair that we lost three babies? Do you think it's fair that Alfie and Hugh are buried thousands of miles away and you're walking around without a scratch? Of course it's not fair, Tom. Not fair at all. We just have to take what life dishes up.
She had landed a shot where Tom was most vulnerable. All these years later, he could not shed the sickening sensation of having cheated. Not cheated death, but cheated his comrades. Having come through unscathed at their expense. Even though logic told him it was nothing but luck one way or another. Isabel could see that she'd winded him and softened.
Tom, we have to do what's right, for Lucy.
Izzy, please.
She cut across him. Not another word, Tom. The only thing we can do is love that little girl as much as she deserves and never, never hurt her. Clutching the doll, she hurried from the room. Now as he looked out over the ocean, blustery and whipped white with foam, the darkness was closing in on all sides. The line between the ocean and the sky became harder to judge as the light faltered second by second. The barometer was falling. There would be a storm before morning. Tom checked the brass handle on the door to the gallery and watched the light turn, steady, impervious. As Tom attended to the light that evening, Isabel sat beside Lucy's cot, watching her drift into sleep. It had taken all her strength to get through the day, and her thoughts still swirled like the gathering storm outside. Now she sang, almost in a whisper, the lullaby Lucy always insisted on.
Blow the wind slowly, slowly.
Her voice struggled to keep the tune.
I stood by the lighthouse the last time we parted. Till darkness came down o'er the deep rolling sea, and no longer I saw the bright bark of my lover.
When Lucy finally nodded off,
Isabel opened her little fingers to remove the pink shell